Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to part two of M.M. Phelps' account of the Battle of Tsushima. And he tells the story of the epic voyage of Imperial Russia's Second Pacific Fleet, as it travelled 18,000 miles from Russia around the Cape of Good Hope to take part in that battle.
Before I say anything else, let me say that the battle itself was almost one of anticlimax, because it lasted an unconscionably brief period because of the superiority, for various reasons which will rapidly become apparent, of the Japanese side. I'll get that over with right at the start. But before I do anything, one of the comments, or several of the comments that I received at the close of the last meeting concerned the fact that a lot of people would like to have seen more of other vessels that could have been involved in the action, scenes at Port Arthur itself, and some of the weapons, etc., which could have been, which would have been involved in it, or similar types. Now, not all of this sort of photographic material is available. In fact, it's damn near impossible to get. So, if you'll bear with me on this, what I have done is to assemble a collection of photographs typical to the period, and which have been assembled from various navies, all of which are within that same period. As a matter of fact, the general designs are almost identical. So, if I could have the lights killed in the first slide, please, Kate. I'm starting out more or less with the development of the large weaponry. Now, what you can see here, I've started out with, is literally the king-size, outsize, and muzzle loaders. This one is a 15-inch muzzle-loading Rodman gun from the Civil War. It fired a 900-pound shell to a range of only about 3.5 miles. I've included it simply because it's virtually the last giant development of the muzzle-loading weapon and is typical of that which would have been used at sea, except that the barrel would have been much longer because of the greater ranges over unimpeded territory, namely water. And, of course, you don't need the howitzer effect. But that is pretty much typical of the type of gun you would have seen at the close of the period immediately prior to the pre-dreadnought. Now, here we are at Port Arthur itself. We see here a Japanese artillery spotting team lining up. Action has already been commenced. And you can see several light field pieces in the bottom foreground. The Japanese didn't have too much heavy stuff there actually mobile in the field. It was generally of about 2.75-inch caliber and would equate to a light field gun. The territory, as you can see, was pretty open, and as you can see from the elevation of the weapons here, the range was, well, pretty extreme. And here we see one of the same light field pieces being manhandled into position. The size of the wheels is noteworthy, and this is to enable the piece to travel over very rough ground. It is in fact a breech loader, and the size of the wheels actually gives a misleading idea of the size of the weapon, because the average Japanese soldier of the time was only about 5'4". But they were worried little so-and-sos, and they managed to do an astoundingly good job. Next, please. Now, this is an 11-inch howitzer. This particular weapon was one of the principal weapons concerned in the siege of Port Arthur. It fired an almighty shell for its time, about 1,000 pounds. Range was very, very good. And in this particular instance, the Japanese led the field, because they gave Alfred von Krupp and his merry men in Essen some ideas as to how to develop heavy howitzers. They were the Japanese were the first to use this type of heavy breech-loading howitzer, and it was these weapons which not only reduced the port of Port Arthur, but in fact sank several of the Russian ships in harbour, up to and including battleships. Their lobbing power was quite fantastic. You can see also in the foreground here, ready-use ammunition. The whole thing was actually on a barbette carriage. There was no recoil mechanism as such. The gun slid back on its carriage and slid back by force of gravity, was pivoted at the breech end and swung around on a circular track on a pivot arrangement by a crank. Next please, go. Now, at the Russian earthworks, we see a similar type of arrangement, only this is elevated. This is the Russian reply. The calibre's 10-inch. On the left you can see an observation post, and it looks like things must have been pretty furry around there because at least a 6-inch brick's gone through it. There is no comment came with the picture as to what happened to the observer up there. Knowing the Russians, I'll bet you anything you like, it wasn't an officer. The firing steps there are pretty extreme. You can see one chap there by the right-hand breech of the gun. Don't know what he's doing, but in the foreground, an interesting little article, see a bit of smoke there. Well, that's rising from a samovar. The average Russian pongo wouldn't travel anywhere without his kappa. Only thing is he did it in a slightly different fashion to the British counterpart. And on the right here you can see a set of steps leading up to the parapet and over. Next please, Kev. Now, here is part of the massive Russian earthworks. These guns, which are 10-inch, are once again on barbette carriages. As I said before, they slide back on recoil. There's no recoil mechanism as such. And it's interesting to note that this was possibly taken after the capture of the port, because there are no breech blocks in the guns. Blocks are open. There's also a lot of ready-use ammo standing around. There's another carriage here, shells here, some of them standing on their noses. Here is the Travis handle. Elevation was at the gun itself, and you have some observers up here, as you can see. Next, please. Now, this is a scene from the actual battle. Now, you may think these carriages are the same as what went before. They're not. They're Moncrief disappearing carriages, which were manufactured all over the world in various guises. Moncrief was the original patentee. He was British. Then, of course, Armstrong's got in on the act. They made him as well. And the best of the lot didn't actually appear until the late 20s in the States. And it was made by a firm called Buffington Crozier from a design developed by one General Buffington. But the whole idea of this piece is that there is a very definite recoil mechanism here. The gun, when it fires, swings back on a pivot, swings straight down, and disappears from view after all recoil. When it's in the lower position, it fastens there, and the piece is loaded, obviously by hand and trolley, and then it is released, and the hydropneumatic mechanism raises the whole piece up to steer its nose over the parapet, at which case it fires again, and the whole cycle is repeated. As you can see, things are a little bit furry there as well. Next, Kurt. Here is part of a detachment of a Japanese Guards Division. Not one of them is smiling. I think they take the whole business very seriously, which they did. It's interesting to note that the siege of Port Arthur was notable for the first use of the Maxim gun, predecessor of the Vickers, in open trench warfare. It was, funnily enough, it was the Russians who used it with absolutely devastating effect. They cut the Japanese down like flies. There were a lot of German and British observers present. The British didn't think too much of the idea. They thought it was rather unsporting, but the Germans took it very, very much to heart, and the lessons were learned about 10 years later. Their rifles were Arisakas, 6.5 calibre, and their bayonets were, oddly enough, of a British pattern. Their uniforms were dark blue. They didn't change to khaki until later in the piece. Next, please, Kip. Rather unique scene, this. Ammo didn't come ready-made from the factory in these days. They actually filled it in the field in a tent by means of a funnel. Now, I can't see any no-smoking regs around, but I understand, judging from some of the accounts I've read, that there were some rather horrific results from the odd Russian brick landed in that lot, because the powder just came out in loose kegs. It was a brown, what they call brown powder or cocoa powder, which was nothing more or less than a derivative of black powder at that stage. They didn't switch over to nitrocellulose until later in the war. Next, please, good. Here are some Russian, Japanese sailors actually on board the Makasa. They look just about the same as any other jet tower in their early time, except once again, they don't think they appreciate having their photograph taken. If anyone knows what this is in the foreground, I'd like to know, because I don't know. Next, please. Now, this is the launching of a pre-dreadnought battleship. As you can see, they were launched pretty much complete with even the stacks up, and on this occasion they rigged a donkey boiler up to a whistle so she could see if she could salute her own launching, which she did. The dots down the side are not scuttles like the Oriana. I think they're simply nothing more or less than jarred rivet patches all the way down, but you can see from this the standard fashion of the day, with the so-called military mast, which is a rather conical structure with fighting tops all the way up. Ram bow, of course, pierced in the side for casement guns, and the bones, bare bones of the bridge structure is already up. That pretty sharp accidentally was taken at William Cramp's yard at Philadelphia in the United States. Next, please, Kip. Here is a 12-inch gun being fitted into position on a ship of that class. You can see the wooden plug still in the breech. Breech is not in position. Measuring marks here. Quite a sophisticated turret design for the period. It's a flat and inclined face, which didn't come in until about 1904. And everyone worked in bowler hats or derbies. Very formal. Next, please, Kurt. Now, here's the battleship Mississippi being fitted out. I've put her in because she's typical of the day and gives you a fair idea of the size. And she only went about 12,000 tons, which means you could hoist the whole lot on board hood and not even notice the difference. Once again, you can see that flat-faced turret. She is about a year from completion at that point. See from the size of the men aboard that she's not particularly large. Next, please, sir. Full power on trials. They, at this particular stage, that particular ship was doing about 19 knots. There wasn't any such thing as telescopic lenses for the Thornton Picard camera in those days, so the poor Joe who took it was actually in the boat for the standard lens. And the caption that came with that photograph is that the chap who took it very nearly lost his life about 5 seconds later because he was damn near swamped. If the bow wave didn't get in, the suction curve down the hull would have, because they didn't have much idea, really, of hull form then. And once you get past the bow wave, then you strike that almighty dip down the hull as the suction effect comes in. If any of you were lucky enough to see last night's programme on the rise of the Red Navy, and to see the suction wave created by a nuclear on the surface, it's unreal. Coal, of course, and they're shoveling like maniacs down below. Next, kid. Here's another one. Once again, she's really belting it out there, although I think the stokers must have had the word put into them because there isn't much of a haze there for the period. She's got most of her guns aboard, but she's still doing builder's trials. You can't see it there, but it is identifiable in the original photograph. That battleship, by the way, is in Nebraska. But they make an impressive sight, believe me. Well, I think you'd agree with me. Next, please, Kip. Here's a pre-dreadnought out of the water. As a matter of fact, she's in a floating dock. What strikes you immediately is the colossal draft of those ships. Fully half her physical vertical hull divisions. You have bilge keels there for once, and the pious hope that they'll stop your rolling. They didn't. Twin funnels up top, which is an inheritance of the British Majestics. Beautiful scrollwork, white hull, and everyone rowing round her down below there, once again wearing the inevitable derby. But they're quite magnificent ships. My heaven, they could eat coal. Next, kid. Where it all happens is where the sweat's really raised, about 150 degrees. Usually, by this stage, they were water tube boilers, usually of a Belleville, Nicklaus pattern. They're usually about anything between 18 and 24. The total complement of any given ship at the time, you could bet your socks that between a third and a half of, or at least a third of the complement would be taken up merely of stokers. They used to chew an almighty amount of coal. There was no such thing as mechanical firing. It was all doing it with the banjo. And, as I say, temperatures were about 150 Fahrenheit down there. Next. That is one of the main engines of an early protected cruiser. Now, you may think, of course it's steam, but you say, where's the engine? Well, actually, it's a triple expansion engine on its side. There were two of them. You're looking at, there's the big ends down here. They were like this because of the height of a triple expansion engine would not permit the protective deck to go over the top and still not have the top protruding through the whole gubbin. So they, until they refined things a bit, they put everything on its side. Next to it. Once again, by this time they'd gone vertical. Everything beautifully clean. This was photos courtesy of the United States Navy. This is a triple expansion engine once again. But as you can see, you didn't have enough room to swing a cap down there. Next, please. And that's where it all came out. That's three of the four funnels on a Russian cruiser. And, they're pretty tall. You can see from the size of the steps how high the funnels were. As a matter of fact, it was pretty much de rigueur in these days to have stacks of 100 feet high. Now that's 100 feet, not from the deck to the funnel caps, but from the boilers to the funnel caps. And most people, when you think of 100 foot stacks, you think, well, from the deck up. Well, it's not. It's from the boilers. Nick? Typical of the time, an open bridge. And I mean open. No such thing as covers, armor plate, or anything else. And if the safety valve lets go, you get deafened. It's right behind you. Conning tower immediately beneath, armoured at least a foot thick and slotted. But even so, a remarkable number of people used to get killed there because flying stuff would come straight through the slot. It's interesting here to note, by the way, that the cowls, ventilating cowls, are turned up. You'd think they'd be turned forward. Must be even too much for those below. Next, please. Wireless. When Rozhdestvensky went to sea, that was about all he had. Photograph was taken about 1904, and the range of that, the huge accumulators and the dot and carry method, wasn't much more than about 50 miles, so it was only good for the modern day equivalent of WT between ships at sea, and that's about it. Next, please. Now, this is a 5.4 inch casement of gun. Typical of the time, this one's a French pattern. Pattern of 1884. Once again, you can see with the way that it pivots. It does have a recoiling action there, hydropneumatic, and was loaded, laid, and fired by hand. Next, please, Kip. Twin 8-inch. Everything done by hand. Local control, no director, no automatic loading, and you get it and grab it and heft it in yourself. And those bricks are about 200 pounds. Rate of fire, about 2.5 per minute. I know it sounds 2.5, but doing it on an aggregate. Once again, it was all manual, sponge out, everything else. But they did have a reasonably respectable range of times, about 7 miles accurate. Next, please. Loading by hand, a 7.1 inch gun. The bloke in the centre is actually hoisting that shell in on his own, and God help your fingers, because there wasn't a loading tray. You just slammed it in, put your fist up, and hoped that the bloke who was swinging the lever to close it wasn't too quick, or you'd lose it. Powder was loose, or rather in bags, not cartridges. Once again, rate of about 2 rounds a minute. Next, please, Jeff. Typical of the time, a 14-inch underwater torpedo tube mount on a ball going out the side of the hull. Now, this sounds all very well until you remember that you've got a big stick sticking out the side of the hull, and there'd be a considerable amount of force being exerted to swing that sideways. So what they did after a while, they'd swing out a shield first, or slay out a shield to actually protect the tube. And of course, this wasn't only to think of the torpedo tube itself, but also the fish, because early in the piece when they didn't do this, they had some rather nasty accidents. So he's belting along at about 15 knots, they say fire one, of course he fires one, the only thing is, when as soon as it's halfway out the tube, it starts to bend. You have the horrible thing of getting a mechanical enema by way of your own tubes. Guaranteed to upset a fine day's steaming. That's only, I'd say, a 14-inch, but the biggest of the day was about 18. Next, please. Gatling guns. They were still standard fare all over the world. The Russians used them a lot in fighting tops. The Japanese didn't use them that much. That one is a .45 caliber and could chat out about 800 rounds a minute, cranking for all your worth. Accuracy was quite good too. They usually carry those in fighting tops or in wings of bridges. Next, please, Kev. This is a one-pounder Schroeder gun, laid and fired by hand like a ruddy great big rifle. Once again, it was a crank open a tiny bit, load the shell, and then swing it yourself, because you didn't have any such thing as mechanical traverse or anything like that. By the way, there was no recoil mechanism, so you just have to hope the mount was strong enough or you'd end up in the drink. Next, please, Jim. Protected cruiser of the day. This was one that was manufactured by the United States but actually ended up in Japanese hands, but long after Tsushima. Very slim, quite fast for a day, so you could do about 21 knots butt out. The same fast as the old Minneapolis. But not really big, as you can judge by the chap in the bows. It's interesting to note, by the way, here, that you do have provision for a bow torpedo tube, which we usually, after a while of fruitless experimentation, papered over, because if the fish failed, you'd run over it. Also, even though you've got horsepipe here, the anchors are still not being, stoppers anchors are not universal at this stage, and so you still found on most ships the anchors being catted, in other words, hauled up by a catted and placed in special recesses in the deck. Or sometimes you'd even find ships with both, a stoppers anchor up the pipes, and at least one bower anchor being catted in the old fashion. Things, old ideas die hard. Next, please. A typical destroyer of the sort you would find in Rostrovensky's navy, and which made an 18,000-mile voyage around the world. Complement about 70, would you believe? At least half of those would be stokers. Only about one or two 12-pounders, if that, usually one or three pounders. A couple of 18-inch tubes, and they'd be good for about 25 knots. They were like cockle shells, and they were absolute hell to work in, and at that stage of the game people weren't being paid hard lying money. By the way, they didn't have too much concern for harbour pollution either in those days. Next, please, Jeff. And if you come alongside too fast and try and be a smarty to impress the Admiral, that's what happens. If you wear the warp, next thing you know you have a first class court of inquiry as to why. But they are very soft, and you'll notice she concertinaed almost very, very neatly. This particular one actually made it home on her own. Looks like the CO's got a couple of his sons up top having butchers as well. Next, please, Kip. Rostrovensky set off around the world with mainly battle wagons, but he was sent after him another squadron, which I'll mention later. Two of which were coast defense battleships, which were totally unsuited for an ocean voyage, but which nevertheless made it. Now, they had horrendously low freeboard. As you can see from here, a bloke standing on a boat, streaking up to reach the bulwarks once he got past the break in the port and so forth. So, in anything but dead calm seas, they were very wet. Next, please. And this is the ship that started the design revolution. This is the Redoutable, built in France about 1870, about 10,000 tons. No turrets, she was what's known as a central battery ship.
You can hear the main battery located here. Big sponson with two guns per side, or usually three, two either end and one going directly at beam. The enormous cutaway here on the side was to allow fore and aft fire. The ram bow is extreme, as you can see. She was actually
a notable vessel insofar as she was the first vessel in the world to be built, or first battleship in the world to be built almost entirely of steel. And she had an absolutely remarkable draft of something like 28 feet, and she could knock out about 15 knots with a clean bottom, everyone shoveling like blazes. Next, please. This is what the design developed into, and from which the Russians notably made great use of. This is the French battleship Gloire.
Note again the great tumble home here, as separated in the last photograph. The still vestiges of the central battery ship. Armament was Colvin, four forward, four aft. This became pretty well standard until the close of the King Edward the Seventh battleship era. Beautiful design tunnels, until that pagoda style. Beauty. With an early form of smoke buckling on it. Once again, the military style now, the French waiting for that in a big way. They also, you had very, very short post holes. And here, now you see a stock of anchor.
Next, please, Kip. And that's it for the time being there. So now you see the sort of ships and armament which would have contested the battle at Tsushima. And now I think I'll get into more or less the formal part of things. At 22:30 hours on the 8th of February 1904, units of the Japanese Navy under the command of Admiral Hiroshi Togo attacked without warning the anchored warships of the Russian Pacific Fleet in their own base at Port Arthur. This attack, which was a severe moral as well as physical blow, put the battleship Repsan and Tsarevich on the bottom and severely damaged the protected cruiser Pallada. Other naval forays made almost simultaneously resulted in the damage or destruction of further Russian vessels, and the cumulative effect of these successes was to virtually neutralize the effectiveness of the Russian Pacific Fleet and to awaken the great powers, including Russia herself, that perhaps Nippon might be a power to be reckoned with in the future. And that actually came to pass some 15 months later. And on the 20th of June 1904, the Tsar convened and presided over a meeting of the Higher Naval Board at St. Petersburg. The reinforcement of the Pacific Fleet, which had been decimated, had become a matter of urgent necessity, and the subject of meeting was to choose the officer best suited to command the relief force, henceforth to be called the 2nd Pacific Squadron. The man finally chosen, excuse me, Chris, next slide please. Yes? Yeah. Good. Next slide, please. Ah, yes, well, I think we've gone a little bit out of skewing here. This is at Port Arthur itself. As you can see, there's the Repsan on the left and the Pobieda on the right. I don't know which ship this is in the foreground. Next, please. There's the Pallada on the left, and the Pobieda, also on the bottom, with some kibitzers, who are always around when a photograph's being taken. Next, please. Right. Next, please, good. And here is the hole through the Pallada. A lot of people said that there wasn't much damage done, but that torpedo hole really put her on the bottom. Next, please, good. Here we have the general locale of the area where the Russian fleet was based, at Tallinn, which was in those days known as the Val. They had to come all the way down here, through the Canadian out, through the English Channel, before they could get even halfway on their way. Next, please, kids. And here is where they have to get to.
Hello there. Oh, sorry. Right there. And Tsushima Island, the island where the donkey is there, between Korea and the home island.
Thank you. Next, please, Kip.
To get there, they have to come round here, through, round the Cape of Good Hope, up here, to the state of Singapore, up to there. 18,000 miles.
A lot of people reckon he wouldn't do it. Next, please, Kip. And here's the man who chose to lead it. Rostovensky himself. The man finally chosen was 54-year-old Admiral Zinovy Petrovich Rostovensky. Born an aristocrat, this fiery, precise disciplinarian entered the Navy as a 17-year-old cadet. His passion for gunnery led to his enrollment in the Artillery Academy, from whence he passed with special distinction. And it was not long before his skills were put to the test in the Russo-Turkish War. His reckless bravery didn't kill him, but a monumental falsehood perpetrated by his commanding officer very nearly brought his promising career to an abrupt halt. The captain, one Baranov, claimed that his command, which was the small arms beam of the Vesta, sank a vastly superior Turkish ironclad, when in fact the Vesta had gone about and fled upon sighting a Turkish vessel. Now, being a subordinate, Rostovensky kept silent, albeit with a rather bad conscience. But after the war, the Turkish admiral, Hobart Pasha, revealed the truth in a letter to a Russian newspaper. And without thinking, or without even consulting Baranov, Rostovensky confirmed the story in a letter to the same newspaper. Now, that sort of thing is just not on. Whether you're right or wrong, it's not exactly a wise thing to drop your own admiral in the soup. Usually has rather nasty consequences. And he did it without any attempt to justify either Baranov or himself. But his luck held out. Baranov was cashiered. And by a miracle, Rostovensky survived. And he not only survived, but he was even promoted. Something which astounded everyone, including Rostovensky himself. Now, his next task was that of reorganizing the gunnery branch of the Bulgarian Navy, which didn't take him long. And in 1885, he was appointed naval attaché in London, where it appears he was both respected and well-liked. In 1894, he received his captaincy, and as commander of Admiral Agatsiev's flagship in the Far East, was thus in a good position to observe the behavior of the combatants during the Sino-Japanese War. He returned to St. Petersburg as commander of the gunnery practice squadron of the Baltic Fleet, and it was during this period that Rostovensky's career received its greatest boost. At 1000 hours on the 24th of June 1902, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany arrived at Revel Roadstead aboard the Imperial yacht Hohenzollern. Now, I had a photograph of the Hohenzollern, and like a fool, I lost it last night, and I still can't find it, so apologies. On the Hohenzollern, accompanied by two German warships for a state visit. And steaming with them was a Russian cruiser and the beautiful, next shot please, Kev, immaculate yacht, the Standart. That's the Tsar's little pushback. Beautiful ship. The vessels whose lines were emulated by the designers of the British Royal Yacht, next please, the Victoria and Albert. Now, not many people know that, but the bloke, I think it was Watts who designed the Albert, the Victoria and Albert. He got his ideas from the Standart, but the V&A wasn't that much of a success. For instance, they made a mistake when designing her, and almost immediately upon launching, she turned turtle. Queen Victoria never liked it. She usually used the Enchantress. And from the time she was built to the end of her days, the V&A went about with over 500 tons of concrete in the bottom to keep her upright. And who on this day, well, the Standart, carried the host, Tsar Nicholas II. After the mind-warping thunder and smoke of the simultaneous 31-gun salutes had passed, the royal parties and their staff lunched aboard the Standart. And following this lavish repast, which lasted until 1500, all persons present changed into more serviceable uniforms and boarded the cruiser Minnan to witness at sea a three-hour gunnery demonstration by selected battleships and other picked units of the Russian fleet. The excellence of this demonstration, with its steady, extremely accurate fire from all vessels, greatly impressed the Kaiser. He publicly commended Rostovensky in the presence of the Tsar and his own Admiral von Tirpitz. And such praise from a monarch of a country noted for gunnery excellence did not go unnoticed, and in rapid succession, Rostovensky was promoted to Rear Admiral, made Chief of the Naval Staff, and at the same time ADC to the Tsar. Now, charged with the task of assembling the 2nd Pacific Squadron, next please, Dick. Thank you, leave it like that. Rostovensky descended on the grass-ridden and labyrinthine warren of the Naval Victualling and Purchasing Department like the Seven Plagues of Egypt. And within 3 months, this one-man cyclone had succeeded in making himself the most unpopular officer in the Admiralty. The rusty, corrupt machinery had not seen the oil of a forceful personality for many a year, and Rostovensky worked 18 hours a day in order that his fleet might be made ready in the shortest possible time, and that its needs would be fulfilled. Every conceivable item needed by a fleet on its long voyage of war had to be obtained virtually at the rush. shells and propellant of all calibers, mines, belts of Maxim gun ammunition, torpedoes, scuttling charges, if needed, charts for all vessels, engine room and auxiliary machinery spares, all had to be found. Even such items as office equipment and reams of various forms and even toilet paper were procured and placed aboard the fighting vessels and transports of this rapidly burgeoning fleet. And because of the varying latitudes through which the ships would pass, provision had to be made for extra clothing for the men as well as their food. And that included salt meat, which was delivered by the barrel load, tins of butter, boxes of biscuits and dehydrated vegetables for soup making, salt preservatives, and last but not least, hundreds upon hundreds of crates of vodka and a good quality champagne for the officers, whose accommodation and comfort were attended to extremely assiduously in the Tsarist Navy. They had the happy habit of, if things weren't exactly to the officers' taste, of adding things on an ad hoc basis to the construction of ships, which usually resulted in them being extremely top-heavy and having very poor steering characteristics. Now, Rostovensky's recurrent nightmare was coal. He knew from experience that the boilers and engines of certain units were not very efficient, and that the likelihood of their being overhauled prior to departure was remote, and this meant very high daily fuel consumption. Two light cruisers in particular, the Jemchug and the Izumrud, each burned 21 tons of coal per hour at 90% power. The colonial navies of Great Britain, France and Germany possessed vast networks of coaling stations in all parts of the world, and Japan could be sure of access to British coaling facilities should the need ever arise. But this wasn't the luck of Russia, whose supplies were virtually restricted to her own waters and ports. And yet, in spite of all this, Rostovensky proposed an 18,000-mile voyage with an entire fleet around the Cape of Good Hope to the coast of China. Well, it was thought to be impossible, but not to Rostovensky, who personally entered into a contract with the Hamburg America Line for that company to supply the entire 2nd Pacific Squadron with coal from a vast fleet train of 60 colliers spread around the world from the Baltic to the Yellow Sea. The estimate of coal required reached the truly colossal figure of approximately 500,000 tons. And even the British expressed astonishment, and they didn't think the Russians could do it. The day of departure from Kronstadt arrived. July 15 was the expected sailing date. However, Rostovensky's problems seemingly defied resolution, and so this date was abandoned. One of the main problems was the shortage of qualified personnel, the cream of which was in the Far East with the hamstrung original Pacific fleet. Competent specialist officers were also in short supply, the engineering branch in particular being so affected. Rostovensky corrected the numerical shortage situation among his ratings by accepting into the ranks reservists, poor quality conscripts, and as many merchant seamen as he could get. But this solution brought its own problems, as many of these were useless without adequate retraining, and the remainder contained a large revolutionary element. Now, at this time, it's worth remembering that social reform in Russia, or the agitation for same, had been going on for about 30-odd years. Many of the Tsar's own relatives had been killed by assassination and bomb plots, and the Easter Rising of 1905 was not far away. The first problem of training Rostovensky half completed prior to departure, with the object of completing the rest of the task as the voyage progressed. The extent of the second was not to be fully realized until the voyage was underway, by which time really effective countermeasures against revolutionaries could not be successfully implemented. This category included a small percentage of officers, which were the cause of endless problems which ranged from the spreading of spoken and written sedition to acts of deliberate sabotage. As the formation of the varied units of the 2nd Pacific Squadron was almost complete, these acts of sabotage assumed serious proportions. Repositioning the soft iron compensating spheres on a cruiser's magnetic compass was bad enough, but seriously damaging the main engine cylinder bores on the brand new Oriole was a different matter. When she went on trials, they heard a rather nasty rattling sound. When they lifted the heads off, they found that somebody had placed almost half a ton of scrap iron in the boiler, in the cylinders, which resulted in the whole thing being wrecked, or one main engine being wrecked. The end result of the subsequent investigation is obscure, but one thing is certain. Rostovensky's harsh security measures made a recurrence of that magnitude very unlikely. Rostovensky finally succeeded in gathering together sufficient new and refurbished vessels of all types to make up, on paper at least, an effective fleet. On August 1904, saw Admiral Rostovensky hoist his flag aboard the imposing new black hull battleship Nyaz Suvorov in Kronstadt Roadstead, thereby officially assuming command of the 2nd Pacific Squadron. His fleet consisted of 42 of some of the most ill-assorted vessels imaginable when one considers the extent of the anticipated enterprise. Next speaker. Well, this is one of the main units. She's the latest battleship in the fleet, the Nyaz Suvorov, and she was, in fact, the flagship. As you can see, a marked similarity to the French battleship de Gloire, as I showed you earlier. Very short forecastle. Once again, 12-inch, four and aft. But they were a curious mixture of ancient and modern. They had they were supposed to be equipped with modern bow and stroud rangefinders. In fact, they lacked the KG-5 craft that chased the Bismarck. Some of the civvies were still on board when she sailed, trying to cut holes through the turrets to accommodate these rangefinders and also trying to fit them on top. So you had, on the one hand, modern rangefinders, but on the other hand, you had no director control at all, and in fact, the guns were fired by a percussion cap and a lanyard, and this is in the main turrets. So you can imagine that when they said open fire and you fire a broadside, you'd have one, two, three, four, if you're lucky. And the whole ship shook. So you could do about 18 knots. Horsepower about 16,500. You had 20 Belvoir boilers. As well as the 4 12-inch, you had 12 6-inch as well, and various calibers down to 3-inch, 3-pounder and 1-pounders, and 3 18-inch tubes, and a 10-inch Krupp armor belt. Next please, Kev. Here's her sister ship, the Orel. Now, I don't know what they're doing up forward, but it looks like they're tipping gash over the side. Once again, you can see the tattered anchors there, and the extent of the float end. Next, Kev. This ship is the Oslia Bayer. You'll hear more of her later, but what happened to her was quite horrible. She had 4 10-inch man armor. It was only 12,670 tons, laid down in 1898. 30 Belvoir boilers, 19 knots, and coal supply pretty heavy. She also carried liquid fuel. She was very unreliable at high speed. Next clip. This ship is the Navarin, commonly known as the Factory. Originally designed more or less as a coast defense battleship, fuels her coal consumption extremely high. She was said to be able to steam far better than would be expected and can do over 14 knots. Marvelous. 4 12-inch, 35 caliber. Caliber meaning, of course, not the diameter of the hole in the steel, but the length of the barrel, the figure being arrived at as multiples of the diameter of the bore, in other words, 35 times 12-inch. So she was actually an adaptation of the Trafalgar, Trafalgar class of British battleships, with a few modifications, which the Russians always did. Not always with the greatest success. Next speaker. The Russian battleship Sissoi Veliki, a real coal eater. She had a very serious design defect insofar as her main guns could only be loaded when the guns were trained in a fore and aft position. So you train them on the beam, let fly, then train them back to fore and aft because the loading mechanisms were actually fastened to the fore and aft bulkheads. Now, you can imagine what happens is fire, let go, then say, excuse me, folks, I'm going to train for and aft, please don't fire, in which case you get zapped. Next, please, sir. Now, you might recall that ship that I showed you earlier, the coast defense battleship with a very low freeboard. This is the General Admiral Graf Apraxin, generally known as the Apraxin. I'll refer to her as such. 3 10-inch, 2 forward, 1 aft. Only 4,200 tons with a 404-man complement, a 10-inch Harvey armored belt, and a draft of 17.5 feet. 8 cylindrical boilers, 16 knots, so she could actually go better than what was supposed to be one of the latest battleships of the line. Next. And here we have the Admirals Ushakov and Senyavin. Slightly smaller versions of that which went earlier. There are only 4,200, but they had 4 9-inch 8-cylindrical boilers, once again 16 knots. Now, as it turned out, these ships fought better than just about anything else the Russians had, and with very accurate fire as well. Next clip. Latest cruiser of the day, the Dmitry Donskoy. She had only 6 6-inch, and despite her antiquated appearance, towering sides and square rig, she had fought one of the hardest of her day and went down with all guns firing. She never surrendered. As the boat burns out, colossal draft, 25 and a quarter feet on a tonnage of only 5,880. And she was really going to manage 14 knots. Next clip. Her sister ship, the Vladimir Monomach. She had less armour, 5 6-inch. About the same size and about the same performance. She had most of her armament encasements in the sides and nothing in turrets on the deck. Next clip. The Admiral Nakhimov, which was originally designed to be an armoured cruiser, but she had a rather good overhaul and was in very good nick by the time she got to Tsushima itself. She had a 10-inch compound main armour belt, and she carried her main 6-inch 45 calibre guns in 4 twin turrets. She had a very heavy secondary armament of 10 4.7-inch guns. Now, here we have Admiral Nebogatov, who headed what was to become the 2nd Division of, or rather the 3rd Pacific Squadron. I keep saying Pacific, it's very hard not to. He was the exact antithesis of Ostrovensky. I don't have any details on his early career, but instead of being a fiery man, he was a rather gentle bloke who did the sensible thing and surrendered. And he got sentenced to a firing squad for his trouble. Next picture. And there is his battleship, well, his flagship, the Emperor Nicholas I. 9,900 tons, 2 12-inch, and the sheerest sides in the Russian Navy. You could hardly miss her. A lot of people used to criticise the Kent-class cruisers, but I think she'd beat them. She was quite heavily armoured. Was actually re-engined and re-boiled in 1902, and she was quite capable of steaming 16 knots, and in fact she did 17 on one occasion, at a 14-inch belt. Actually quite a reliable ship for her antiquated appearance. Next picture. Now this is a poor photograph, and I apologise for it, but it's actually one of the latest in the fleet. This is the so-called the Izumrud and the Jemchug, which had that colossal fuel consumption of over 25 tons an hour, which is enormous even by the standards of the day. But even so, for all her 3,050 tons, all she carried was 6 4.7s. Open mounts, I might add. And only a 2-inch armour on the deck, nothing on the sides, and only 3 inches on the conning tower. So if she copped a big one aboard, that would be it. Next please, here. This is the beautiful little Almaz, a light cruiser. Believe it or not, she looks more like a yacht than a light cruiser. She had a speed of 19 knots, which is the fastest of the fleet, but that was about the only thing that could be useful about her. She had 16 Belvoir boilers and only 4 12-pounders. She was rated as a cruiser. Now, not unnaturally, her commander saw the wisdom of the action, and when he saw the big fellows getting at it, decided that discretion was the better part of a medal and left the scene. You can hardly blame it. Here is the famous Aurora in Northern Baltic Fleet colours, black hull, buff tops, and buff funnels and black tops. This was the cruiser that was reputed to have fired the shot that started the 1917 revolution, long after she'd been retired as a frontline unit. She was quite fast. She could do about 18 to 19 knots on 24 boilers, and her fuel was somewhat more moderate. She used liquid fuel as well. It was a kind of naphtha, I believe. She was notable for having no wood at all in her construction. So everything aboard her was made of non-combustible material as much as possible. It's one of the main reasons why she survived. Next, please. This is her as she lies now at Leningrad, old St. Petersburg. The gun on the forecastle is the one that is supposed to have fired the shot. You can go and photograph her, you can go aboard her, but you can photograph her from the shore, but the Russians still won't let you photograph anything aboard. Now, I think we've progressed to something a little bit more modern, so I don't think we have too many secrets to gain from her. But she's quite typical of her time. Next, please, Phil. Here is the cruiser Bogatyr. I beg your pardon, this is the Oleg. The Bogatyr was not there. 12-6 inch, usually pretty fast. She could do about 19 knots, and boilers need considerable cleaning to do any good work. She was not particularly efficient in that respect. But she had French boilers, which were notable for the time, and she carried over 700 tons of coal and got rid of it at 19 tons to the hour. So they needed those colliers. Next clip. And here's the last of the lot, or last of the main unit, the little cruiser Svetlana, only 3,900 tons, which she did herself rather well. 6 6-inch guns of a French pattern. Here is a rather unique photograph. It shows the old cruiser, the Askold, which was actually at Port Arthur, but didn't go to Tsushima. Enormous stacks. She has 5 stacks. There, they were 80 feet. And she was only about 3,000 tons. Oh, this was after the, about 1920, was it? What did you say, about
1919?
Yeah, at the time of the White and White Navy. Okay, Kev, next please. And there is, I love the caption at the top, mostly sunk. They carried quite a few of these small TBDs along with them. As you can see, they're very similar to the British Yarrow pattern. The one which was notable in the action is the first name there, the Buini. You'll hear more of her later. Right. The beginning of September 1904 saw the 2nd Pacific Squadron leave Kronstadt on a 2-week shakedown cruise in which the principal units practiced moving in close formation, station keeping, defence drills, gunnery and torpedo firing exercises, mine laying and sweeping and tactical exercises, the last being a dismal failure and the remainder being accomplished at best with only a modicum of expertise. Engine room breakdowns were frequent, the Borodino suffering the first of her many engine bearing troubles, and the steering gears on both the Naya Suvarov, the flagship, and the Oriole proved to be almost permanently faulty. Signals from the flagship were often completely ignored, and upon discovering that the firing of blank cartridges from saluting guns at the effective vessels had little or no effect, Rostovensky resorted to firing live ammunition across the bows of the offending vessels. On one or two occasions, they hit. He would also indulge in bitter public reprimands of his COs, which was not good for discipline, and had a rather curious predilection to completely losing his temper on some occasions, to the extent where he would actually hurl the nearest pair of binoculars at the offender's head. Usually they went over the side, having a most damaging effect on the list of permanent stores. The fleet steamed to Revel, where the magazines and victualling holds were replenished, and from where, on the 9th of October, the Tsar officially farewelled the ships and their commander-in-chief. And the 2nd Pacific Squadron's odyssey actually began on the 11th of October 1904. And after topping up with coal at Libo, the vast armada made its way through the Skagerrak and into the North Sea and south into the English Channel. Overzealous efforts on the part of Russian intelligence agents implanted on the coastlines of countries along their route resulted in grossly inflated reports of non-existent shadowing fleets of Japanese torpedo boats. They even thought that balloons, or that the moon, was balloons sent up by Japanese TBDs. But the most serious case of false identification occurred off the Dogger Bank, when the heavy units filed through the middle of the large fleet of British trawlers, believing them to be marauding flotilla of TBDs, again. Next, please, Kev. I'm sorry, it appears we have a blue. Could you go on, please? Sorry, I've mucked it up. Close it. Shut it down, Richard. Under the pitiless glare of searchlights, the trawlers were smothered by a hail of badly directed shellfire, which sank one of the little steamers, decapitated two men, and damaged several other vessels, with resultant injuries to personnel. The incident nearly precipitated war between England and Russia, and caused the home fleet to be brought to a state of readiness. It wasn't until he arrived at the Spanish port of Vigo that Rozhdestvensky was made aware of the uproar his ships had caused, and the Spaniards sent him on his way after a very hasty recoaling. He sent a couple of officers back to St. Petersburg to smooth things over, and sent two conciliatory cables of regret to Britain. He also took the time out to offload a pernicious admiralty pseudo-savant and parasite by the name of Captain Nicholas Clardo, who with the Admiralty's approval had attached himself to Rozhdestvensky's staff as a quote advisor unquote. The two men loathed each other, and letting an enemy of that magnitude go free to wreak havoc against him at the Admiralty was one of Rozhdestvensky's greatest tactical blunders. When they arrived at Tangier, the Sultans made the Russians welcome, and coaling proceeded without incident. A 1,000-ton cargo of frozen meat arrived on the transport, and as did a snowy white hospital ship, the Oriole, which was actually a converted liner. Her untouchable staff of 100 aristocratic female nurses were also the subject of much ribald comment. However, the comment reached new heights when Rozhdestvensky announced his intention of dividing the fleet. The Oslia Bayer joined the 1st Division, and Admiral von Torkelsen, who was in charge of the 2nd Division, was directed to proceed through the Mediterranean to Suez and take along with him the battleships Sissoi Veliki and Navarin, together with the TBDs and three light cruisers. He was directed to rejoin the remainder of the squadron at Madagascar. The departure of this now reduced squadron from Tangier was accompanied by the usual chaos of the ships attempting to take station relative to each other, the highlight of which came when one of the battleships caught her bower anchor in a submarine cable. Seamanship went by the board. The simplest method of freeing the anchor was to sever the cable. Thus it was that Europe heard nothing of North Africa for 4 days. The heat of Dakar made the normally back-breaking task of coaling an absolute nightmare. Not knowing when next he would have unhindered port facilities, Rozhdestvensky gave orders to take on double the normal quantity of coal, and the bunker surplus was stacked wherever it could be found in bags, in officers' cabins, alleyways, companionways, even in deserted companionways. The heat, extreme humidity, and filthy dust made conditions ripe for discontent, and it was not surprising that the first rustlings of mutiny were heard here. These now normally overloaded warships were now almost lethally top-heavy, and as sluggish as waterlogged scows. The lower gun ports became unworkable, and the protective armour belts made useless by submergence. Nevertheless, the Cape Squadron staggered on at an average 8 knots, first to Gaboon, and then to Libreville, then to Greatfish Bay, where the Portuguese made them unwelcome, and the Russian Navy were told to move on. They then arrived at the German African port of Agrippaquena, and they had a much-needed welcome on the 11th of December, and this was the last opportunity to take coal before making the long journey around the Cape to Madagascar. Coaling resumed on the 15th of September, on the 15th of December, and the squadron finally left African shores on the 17th. Rozhdestvensky expected to find a cruiser from Torkelsen's detached squadron waiting for him upon his arrival at New Year's Day at the Madagascan port of St. Marie, to convey the information that Torkelsen was anchored. When Rozhdestvensky found to his fury that one of Torkelsen's ships was not there, he sent the tug Roos to find him. And meanwhile, a collier arrived from Torkelsen with the news that he, on Admiralty orders, was at Nosy Be in Madagascar, on the northeast coast, overhauling his engines. And hard on her heels came the Roos, whose captain returned with the disastrous news of Torkelsen, that Port Arthur had fallen to the Japanese, that the remnants of the Pacific Squadron had been captured or destroyed by siege artillery, and therefore the 2nd Pacific Squadron was no longer a relief force, and D, Russia had lost her last adequate base on the Pacific. It was the fall of Port Arthur that caused their old French allies to yield to British and Japanese pressure and deny them the use of their port, which explained further why Torkelsen was at Mercy Bay. And that wasn't the end of it, because the Hamburg-America line, who had contracted with Rozhdestvensky for coal, were now faced with a Japanese threat of a reprisal at sea if they continued to supply the squadron. The company's civilian crews not unnaturally balked at this. They didn't like the idea of being fired on and gave notice to quit and to break contract. Well, without consulting St. Petersburg, Rostovinsky negotiated privately with the company and ended up purchasing all the colliers and their contents outright and placing his own scratch crews aboard them. And to cap it off, he wrung a promise from the Lion to have a further four colliers meet him near Saigon. Newspapers from home brought tidings of political upheavals and violence. The Admiralty cabled Rostovinsky instructions that directed him to stay put at Nosy Be and to await reinforcements. The fleet swung round its anchors for weeks and rotted. The heat, inactivity, boredom with a sleazy port, and finally the horrible news of the massacre of demonstrators outside the Winter Palace had finally provoked open mutiny. The Borodino, the Alexandra, the Third, and even the flagship were the victims of various degrees of rebellion. An officer on the Ural beat his captain insensible, and on the Nakhimov, mutineers rushed the bridge, desisting only when the captain drew their attention to the fact that the flagship had swung its main armament on them. Finally, a previously suppressed report came to light of an assault by three officers on one of the nurses from the Oriole. Courts-martial became a daily occurrence, and more than once the chilly sound of a firing squad echoed across the anchorage. Disease and mental aberration also took their toll, and finally Rostovinsky packed the mutineers and the more seriously ill and the worst lunacy cases into the transport Malay and sent her home with a double guard aboard. Troubles at least contained, Rostovinsky implemented serious gunnery exercises in order that the appropriate personnel be made familiar with the new telescopic sights. However, lack of spare ammunition curtailed the training program, but nevertheless the standard of shooting did improve. Meanwhile, back at St. Petersburg, Klado, the officer that Rostovinsky offloaded, had been hard at work, and he finally convinced the Admiralty that with the fall of Port Arthur, Rostovinsky would need greater support, and so they sent out to him even more decrepit reinforcements to bolster Rostovinsky's cumbersome fleet. Many officers, including, as it turned out, amongst the 2nd Pacific Squadron, were in favour of the move, pointing to the additional firepower the old ships would provide, completely forgetting the inadequate range of their obsolete guns, and that the superannuated engines of that old fleet would even further reduce the fleet's speed. In spite of this obvious logic, the 3rd Pacific Squadron was hastily cobbled together, and the Admiralty chose as its Commander-in-Chief Nebogatov, who you've just seen, and he raised his flag on the Tsar Nicholas I. Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, the warships of the Japanese fleet, under the command of Togo, who was British-trained, had attended courses at Worcester and on board the Victory, were very weary, having been on patrol almost unceasingly since the opening of hostilities with Russia. Their fleet possessed fewer vessels than the Russian, but Togo was not plagued by such crippling handicaps as inferior personnel, indifferently maintained ships, or an uncertain flow of supplies, ammunition, or coal. He lost two of his battleships, the Yoshima and the Hattusa, to mines in one of the first days of the war, and that reduced his available battleship strength by fully one-third, and it was very well kept secret, because that one didn't leak out until the war was over. When his intelligence informed him of the departure of the 2nd Pacific Squadron from Kronstadt, Togo began to recall, in stages, his overworked units so that complete overhauls might be accomplished before Rostovinsky reached the Far East. When he got the news of Nebogatov's departure from Lebo, for once, Togo and Rostovinsky were in agreement. Togo fervently hoped that Rostovinsky would not link forces with Nebogatov, for whilst Rostovinsky regarded the 3rd Pacific Squadron as a liability, Togo viewed the possible arrival of the additional artillery as a grave threat. He had to defeat the Russians swiftly, for yet another very urgent reason. 16 months of war had economically drained Japan, her credit abroad was almost exhausted, and she was close to bankruptcy. If the Russian fleet was allowed to slip through to their sole remaining port, which was Vladivostok, the fleet would continue indefinitely, or the war would continue indefinitely, and Japan would be led absolutely white. If Togo had any doubts as to whether or not Rostovinsky had any intention of fighting a fleet action, they were dispelled when Rostovinsky informed him when intelligence informed him of Rozhestvensky's first strategic error. By this time, Rozhestvensky had already passed through Singapore and was thudding up the coast towards Vladivostok and coming into the South China Sea. When the combined fleet, when the combined Second Pacific Fleet was steaming north through the East China Sea, Rozhestvensky suddenly hove to off the mouth of the Yangtze and detached all his surplus store ships, colliers, auxiliary steamers and armed merchantmen, which anchored in the estuary. He retained the hospital and repair ships together with one supply ship and a few tugs, and the message was quite clear. Rozhestvensky was about to give battle and was clearing his fleet of superfluous vessels. Please, Kev, could I have the next one? It's Togo himself, and I think we can now go to his first ship. Could you? Hello? The Makassar. British built. She is a marvellous vessel. I'll just get the details of her, which I should have here somewhere. I have a... Ah, yes. With 15,200 tons, 4 12-inch, built in the United Kingdom, an almost copy with a few alterations to the better of the King Edward VII class. She was fast, economical, and she was extremely well built. She was built by Vickers, laid down in 1899, completed in 1902. She had 6 automatic searchlights as well. Two-set three-cylinder vertical triple expansion and 25 Belleville boilers. And she could make damn near 19.5 knots, which for a pre-dreadnought was fantastic. Next, please, Kev. There she is alongside in Japan with a fleet of small torpedo boats. She's acting as a mothership there. And again, please, Kev. Here is the Asahi. There were 2 of them actually, the Asahi and the Shikishima. The only difference being virtually between them, the arrangement of the boiler rooms and the funnels. The Shikishima had 3, as you'll see. 4 12-inch once again, about 15,000 tons, slightly earlier than the Makassar. Next, please. There's a 4 turret shot on the Asahi. Quite well detailed, as you can see. Typical of the time, there's not really much I can comment about there, but it's just an interesting photograph which I had not seen before the past few days. Next, please. There's the Shikishima. As you can see, the only difference between her really visually is the funnels. Next, please. Wow. That is the Fuji. I think I turned over too. Yes, I did. Fuji was laid down by Armstrongs of Elswick. She was quite light, actually, 12,300 tons, but she was not really a very good ship. She was not economical at all, but her speed really never exceeded about 15 knots at the best of times. 4-cylinder triple expansion in this instance, and an 18-inch compound armour belt. But don't be fooled by the width of the armour, because an 18-inch compound was only about as strong as about a 12-inch Harvey belt, which was a special process dreamed up by the Carnegie Corporation in the US. Next, please. This is the Qin Yen. Built actually in Germany, she was rated as a battleship, and in fact she had 2 12-inch guns on a tonnage of only 7,350. But she had them in 2 turrets that are only 20 calibre, very short range. She was captured from the Chinese. They went into battle at the Battle of Yalu in her, or her admiral did. He carried very few shells aboard him because he figured that the sight of the guns would actually frighten the Japanese. In fact, most of his shells were not filled with explosives. Some of them had coal dust in them and some had even sawdust. But this ship demonstrated very effectively to the Japanese the fact that armour could protect. She came through with her upper work shot to pieces, but very, very low casualties.
Next, please. And as you can see from this photograph here, her turrets were arranged in echelon, like that on either side, fore and aft prior, not at either end. Next, please. Here is one of the Togo's armoured cruisers, the Kasuga, built in by Ansaldos in Italy and bought by him, and they were originally intended for Argentina. Completed in 1902, they had one 10-inch forward and two 8-inch aft. They are quite modern for their day and were amongst the most modern in the world, in fact. Next, please. There's the Kasuga, her sister ship, earlier on, when she was originally in Italian service, or prior to going out to Argentina. Next, please. Once again, the Kasuga. This is in the 20s. She survived well and truly. Next, please, go. The Azuma, 4 8-inch, built in France, the only actual French-built vessel in the entire war. Next, please, go. This is the Asama, 4 8-inch again, 9,750 tons. Quite fast. Forced draft, 18,000 horsepower and 21.5 knots. Next, please. And the Tokiwa, her sister ship. Once again, very tall funnels, towering freeboard, but a very satisfactory vessel. Next, please. This is the Izumo. 4 8-inch again. 14 6-inch, 1400 tons of coal, and built at the by Armstrong's at Ellswick, as was her next sister ship, the Iwate, coming up. I'm sorry, the Yakumo. I beg your pardon. She was built in Germany in 1897. Again, the standard armed with 4 8-inch, 9,850 tons all up. Next, please. I think I have those in back to front. Sorry, go past it, please, Kip. Now, there is a close-up of the Iwate. Note the cat at anchor. This was taken after the war. Next, please. American built at San Francisco. The Kasagi and Cheetos, the only American-built cruisers there. 4,700 tons and only 2 8-inch. Philadelphia, they're actually, San Francisco, they're actually built at Philadelphia by Cramps in 1898, both of them. Next, please. Now, that was her sister ship, the Cheetos. Next, please, go. The Mitaka and Tsushima. The Tsushima was actually Togo's own flagship back at the Battle of Yalu in 1898. Next, please. The Atowa. She's the only one that I couldn't get any information on at all, save she had 2 4.7-inch guns, 4 and aft. Next, please. The Naniwa. 2 10.2-inch old Krupp, built at Ellswick from the designs of Sir William White. She had new secondary armament in 1900. Next, please. And there is the Chilean cruiser Esmeralda, but which was, in fact, I'm sorry, I've lost my place here. Gone over it. Now, she was originally built for the Chilean Navy and passed to the Japanese Navy not long before the battle, and frankly I have forgotten her name. I beg your pardon, it was the Nishin. Thank you. Next, please. and there is a typical Japanese torpedo boat once again after the British pattern. The Japanese had always shown a liking for cruisers, and their navy has, until recent years, been well endowed with them. The fleet which fought at Tsushima contained many more cruisers than their Russian opponents, although this was done to offset their lack of battleship strength. Many of these cruisers were of foreign origin, however the lessons learned from them were incorporated in the fine designs which were the envy of the world 35 years later. Next, please, Kev. Thank you. The weather began to close in as Rostovensky cleared the Yangtze estuary and headed northeast into Tsushima Straits in the afternoon of the 25th of May. He had hoped that the weather would screen his fleet from Japanese scouts, which, he had been told, were out in quantity. The skies cleared the next day, but the ensuing night was misty. At 0700 hours on the 27th of May, 1905, with heavy seas and a light mist, a strange two-funnel ship appeared to starboard, travelling at high speed. It proved to be the Japanese auxiliary cruiser Shinano Maru, and before a Russian gun could be brought to bear on her, she suddenly went about and disappeared into the mist. The Russians' precarious luck of not being discovered before now had finally run out, and Togo now knew exactly where they were. Rostovensky deployed his battle fleet in two parallel lines. To starboard was the stronger force, headed by the flagship Naya Suvarov, followed by the Alexander III, the Borodino, the Oriol, the Ozliabaya, Sisoveliki, Naviki, and the Nakhamov. In the port line was Nebogatov's flagship, the Tsar Nicholas I, followed up by the Admiral Senyavin, the Apraxin, and the Admiral Yushakov. The cruiser formations formated astern of the heavy units with the scouts Vietlana and Almaz out ahead. A cruiser and a few TBDs were on either flank, and the last vessels in the fleet were the remaining repair and supply and hospital ships. Togo had the inestimable advantage of knowing exactly where the Russians were without exposing his position. He intended to wait until the Russians had cleared Tsushima Island so that his ships would have more manoeuvring room. Having received full intelligence of the Russian disposition, Togo sent units of his cruiser divisions to attack the weaker rear of the Russian fleet whilst he arranged his main battle line ahead of the Russian heavy units. Japanese cruisers once again appeared on the flanks of the Russian fleet, impudently keeping station for well over an hour, and finally the gunners of the Oriol couldn't stand the sight any longer. At 11:20 hours, without waiting for orders, round after round of 6-inch gunfire flashed out from the Oriol and touched off other trigger-happy gunners throughout the fleet before Rostovensky was able to restore order. Without apparent reason, Rostovensky ordered his 1st and 2nd divisions to redeploy to a new location and to increase speed to 11 knots. Whilst the Russians were engaged in this ill-timed manoeuvre, Togo's battle fleet appeared across the horizon and, after leading his ships across the Russians' course, swung in a tight circle to port and thereby crossed the Russian T. As the Japanese ships circled to straighten out on an easterly course, Rostovensky turned his vessels to starboard on a parallel course and at approximately 1400 hours opened fire at the almost unprecedented range of 9,500 yards. The opening salvos were a nasty shock to the Japanese, as they had previously understood Russian shooting to be extremely poor. The 950-pound 12-inch shell howled into the water only 22 yards from the leading Japanese vessels, and even as their bridge staffs watched in amazement and cursed their own delay in opening, the Russian line was again enveloped in smoke as the staccato thunder of another ragged, flashing broadside poured more of the 12 and 6-inch shells into the rigid Japanese formations. This time, some of the large shells landed inboard, and at least a dozen projectiles struck the Makassar at once, and of these, one exploded when it hit the bridge ladder, scattering splinters everywhere and slightly wounding Togo himself. Nebogatov's coast defense flat irons, as they were called, were pumping out surprisingly accurate salvos at Togo's cruisers. His 12 and 10-inch guns ripped into the Yakumo, the cruiser, knocking out the fore turret, and the 12-inch artillery of the Tsar Nicholas I, and damaged the Osama's steering gear and put her out of the line. In those first moments of the battle, the Russians surprised everyone and scored heavily. It was then the turn of the Japanese. Next, please, Kip. Go through that, please. And again. I think we'd better go through this. That was actually coaling, it meant to come earlier. As you can see here, this was actually a shot of the Macassar coming up into the swell. The seas, as you can see, were extremely heavy. Next, please, Kip. And again. That's quite an impressive shot. It's of the Japanese fleet taken at close quarters from a TBD, actually. Next, please, Kip. Thank you. It was then the turn of the Japanese. Recovering quickly from the Russian onslaught, they cleared for action. The ponderous turrets of the main battle line swung around to the estimated bearing, and seconds later, a sparkling multiple flash from the Macassar heralded the awe-inspiring reply to the challenge. The experienced Japanese gun crews had stood fast during the initial Russian bombardment, and with disciplined thoroughness, each ship fired carefully aimed sighting rounds, and after finding the range, gradually increased the rate of fire to one of furious, devastating accuracy. The poor Russian crews, lacking the type of esprit de corps that sustained their Japanese opposite numbers, were not prepared for what happened. Togo's ships were firing direct-action, Shimose-filled shells with extremely sensitive noses that exploded on contact with anything solid, even a funnel guy. And the object was to sweep the decks clear of personnel and to turn the less protected areas into a blazing wasteland, thereby completely demoralizing the crews to the point where they could not work their ships effectively. Next, please, Kip. There you see the Japanese opening fire. The ship to the left is the Shikishima. Next, please, Kip. The sketch done at the time of the battle on Togo's own bridge. It appears that they went into battle in full dress uniform, completely scorning any type of protective clothing, and as you can see, being British organised, the Japanese sailors are still wearing Senate hats in the manner of our lads of the early days. It's a matter of interest that a Royal Navy officer was actually present on board the Macassar. He sat in a deck chair down aft while the action was going on, taking notes copiously, and observing the whole thing through his field glasses while the 12-inch turret was rabbiting away about 20 feet from him. He finally went below, not because of the din, but because of the Japanese shell fire. It wet him, and he was very put out by that, and apparently he was quite upset at missing even 10 minutes of the battle, but he came back up later and resumed his position in the deck chair on the quarterdeck. That's how we come to know so much about what happened from the Japanese side. Next, please, Kip. Thank you. Right. Captain Vladimir Semenov had served under Vice Admiral Makarov on the Far East and was now a supernumerary aboard the Nyaz Suvarov under Rozhdestvensky. He left a horribly detailed account of the hell created by the Japanese shell fire. It seemed impossible even to count the number of projectiles striking us. I had not only never before witnessed such a fire before, but I had never imagined anything like it. Shells seemed to be pouring upon us incessantly, one after another. Steel plates and superstructure on the upper deck were torn to pieces, and the splinters caused many casualties. Iron ladders crumpled up into rings, and guns were literally hurled from their mountings. Such havoc could never have been caused by the simple impact of a shell, still less by that of its splinters. It could only be caused by the force of the explosion. And that's pretty accurate, because Shimose, which the Japanese were using, was nothing more or less than a Japanese version of the very potent British explosive lyddite. And if any of you have ever been on the receiving end of the equivalent of lyddite, I think you'd know what I meant. In addition to this, there was the unusually liquid temperature, there was the unusually high temperature and liquid flame of the explosion that seemed to spread over everything. I actually watched a steel plate catch fire from a burst. Of course, the steel did not burn, but the paint on it did. Such almost incombustible materials as hammocks, which had been saturated with water before the battle, and rows of boxes flared up in a moment. At times it was almost impossible to see anything with glasses owing to everything being so distorted with the quivering heated air. A Japanese officer later stated his impression was that, and I quote, "At first the Russians shot fairly well, causing some loss of life at the more exposed stations on board our leading ships, but after the first 20 minutes they suddenly seemed to go all to pieces, and their shooting became wild and almost harmless," and it's really no wonder.
At approximately 14:20 hours, Togo changed to armor-piercing shell, and having closed a little over a mile, the carnage was appalling as hit after hit flooded into the vitals of Rostovensky's demoralized vessels. The battleship Ozlia Baia was the first to go. Her sheer walls made an absolutely perfect target, which the Asahi could hardly miss. 3 12-inch hits on the bows peeled off the heavy armor like onion skin, admitting the heaving seas which poured in and finished her in approximately 10 minutes. It's interesting to note that, according to a survivor, shortly before she went down, her captain had ordered her brig to be cleared. And the inmates thought they were going to be gladly released from a watery grave. Not so. The captain was fully determined that these condemned men were to go. He had them fastened to the fore turret. Not long after that, a 12-inch shell hit the fore turret and they were not seen again. But apparently their screaming could be heard all through the ship and completely demoralized the crew who were in earshot. It was a very bad move. Admiral Felkerson accompanied the Ozlia Baia to the bottom. He had not died in action, but from a final massive stroke the previous evening, and for reason of morale, only Rostovensky, the ship's captain, and the medical staff knew of the event. The Naya Suvarov, the flagship, was slowly being transformed from a fine modern vessel into a red-hot ruin. With most of her topsides virtually unrecognizable, and with both funnels gone, she absorbed a heavy shell in the steering gear, thereby causing her to swing uncontrollably out of the line. By now, Rostovensky had been seriously wounded himself, and the captain had been killed. The ship drifted slowly eastwards, and for about 30 minutes, the shellfire lifted from her. The Alexander III thus became the leading ship. Her captain, with no orders from his wounded admiral on the blazing wreck astern, led the remainder of the 1st Division in a great circle to the south, and then turned back north, for no apparent reason. Togo started to follow them around, and then, seeing the Alexander III's intention, reversed course again, and again crossed the T. As the two battle lines converged on a collision course, the fire of every conceivable Japanese vessel concentrated on the Alexander III. She turned east in an attempt to escape the murderous fire that soon dropped out of line, leaking like a sieve and with roaring fires aboard. Borodino took over the dangerous role of lead ship. Togo drew up his forces again, and his clean bottom hulls, fresh out of dock, were able to outsteam and outmaneuver the fouled Russian vessels, which had been in the water for over 7 months and which had over a foot of weed on their bottom. However, his cruisers had absorbed heavy battle damage while chasing the smaller units. The old Dmitry Donskoy, the high-walled square rigger, carried herself into fame by beating off and seriously damaging no less than 4 Japanese light cruisers, sinking 2 TBDs and damaging a third before being captured. No one left aboard was unwounded, all guns were shattered, and she finally sank from her injuries. The Japanese Admiral Dewar's flagship, the Kasagi, was hauled herself below the waterline and headed for home. The cruiser Naniwa was similarly hit and dropped out of the fight. The whole Russian fleet by late afternoon was in an almost helpless huddle under the fire of Togo's main line to the east and by his cruisers from the south. Rostovensky was again seriously wounded and lay almost insensible and paralyzed in his lower limbs on the floor of a 6-inch turret, all the control stations on his flagship being shot to scrap iron. The little TBD, the Buini, was summoned alongside the blazing Naya Suvarov, and showing tremendous courage, the little craft captain brought her alongside in the heaving swell, and Rostovensky was gently lowered over the side. The Japanese now turned their attention once again to the tortured flagship Naya Suvarov. Hardly a gun was able to fire, yet she refused to strike her colors. Their tormentors marveled at her courage as they rammed point-blank fire into her flaming hulk from a range of only 200 yards. Rostovensky, his chief of staff, Semenov, and a few sailors had already left in the Buini. With her engine stopped, Naya Suvarov was manned now only by a handful of volunteers in the stern, firing a lone 12-pounder gun, and who perished to a man with her when she finally succumbed to 4 torpedoes at 1900 hours on the first day. Nebogatov, aboard the Tsar Nicholas I, was now the commander-in-chief. Rostovensky had given him orders to push on to Vladivostok and to take with him what was left of the Pacific Squadron. The Borodino still led the Russian battleship line, and astern of her limped her sister ship the Oriol and another sister, the Alexander III, the damage to which had been partially repaired. Behind them came the remainder of the squadron in a confused group, including Nebogatov's own ships, which had been largely ignored by Togo, who had wisely concentrated his fire on the more modern vessels.
with the coming of night, the Alexander III finally gave up the struggle to stay afloat, and she slowly rolled over on her side and died. A few minutes later, the fires aboard the Borodino reached her magazine, and she disappeared in a gigantic explosion. As night fell, the Japanese battle line suddenly withdrew from the killing ground, and the Russians soon found out why. Over 80 Japanese torpedo boat destroyers sailed out from prearranged bays and small ports into the heavy seas and fell upon the struggling battleships. Only the total blackness of the night, coupled with the increasingly foul sea, saved the Russians from complete annihilation. The Navarin, the factory, absorbed two torpedoes and sank the next morning. Other ships were hit and damaged but did not sink. The Japanese lost two torpedoes to gunfire, and in the wild seas, two others were severely damaged by collisions. Daybreak found the Russians scattered all over the Sea of Japan. Only Nebogatov's original squadron was largely intact, but outranged and outgunned, he acted wisely and surrendered. There remained only the stragglers to be mopped up. Some Russian vessels refused to surrender and went down with their remaining guns firing until the barrels burnt out. The cruiser Svetlana and the coast defense ship Admiral Ushakov were in this courageous bracket. The cruisers Oleg, the famous Aurora herself, the Jemchug, escaped on the night of the 27th and went to Manila and interned. The Izumrud simply fled the scene and ran aground at the entrance of the Russian port of Vladimir Bay in Siberia and was scuttled where she lay. She's still there, by the way. Other vessels simply sank from their injuries. The remainder of the warships, large and small, either fled into internment or were captured by Togo and ultimately repaired and added to the overwhelmingly victorious Japanese fleet, which lost only two small TVDs in the night and suffered no major crippling damage at all to any of his large ships. Here, could you put the new box in, please, the small one? Here's some of the damage on board the Russian ships when they finally got in. As you can see, this funnel is holed, shrapnel all over the place. Holding the funnels on these days when there was virtually no forced draft was the equivalent of dismasting our sailing ship, because the draft was destroyed, she couldn't keep steam up, and she'd just rapidly drop astern. And coal consumption went up to an enormous rate. Next, please, Kip. This is the damage to the Petropavlovsk. The fore turret's roof has been blown completely off. She's lost the top of the mainmast. The conning tower has had its roof bent slightly askew. And as you can see, there's general wreckage around. Also, the top of the bridge has been completely blown away, leaving it open. Next, please. This is on the Oriole after capture. You can see the enormous sheer sides, which permitted 4.5 fire for the auxiliary armament, an enormous 12-inch shell hole clean through. Just about anything else that was around penetrated as well. Then the curious belted nozzles were a survival from muzzle-loading days, and they were still on some of the more modern vessels. Next, please. That is the forecastle of the Oriole. Notice that the muzzle of the port gun there has been completely blown off. She's got numerous shell holes and damage there, but she was largely captured intact. Next, please. This is looking along the main deck. As you can see, the rain of fire was almost complete. The last time I saw a photograph of wreckage like that was of the Emden. Curious enough, the funnels are still up, but just about nothing else there is recognizable. She was hit with just about everything conceivable, mainly 6-inch, which was specifically directed to a midship part. The 12-inch guns concentrating mainly on the armor deck and the fore part of the ship. Next, please. There's the Admiral Senyavin being led in to Yokohama and capture. As you can see, the Japanese went absolutely mad. Quite a few ships were incorporated into it, and I'll look if we've got the details here in a second. Newly incorporated into the Japanese fleet. Next, please. There's a shot of the celebration street scenes in Yokohama. They went quite mad at the occasion. It's the first time that Japan had ever got the upper hand on a major European power, and it woke everyone up to what she was doing. Just hold it there for a second, will you? During the night, the ship on which had been placed Admiral Rostovensky, the destroyer Bueni, ran out of coal, and Rostovensky and his staff transferred to her sister ship, the Biodovi, which in company with other Russian units was making for Vladivostok. She was captured the next morning on the 28th, and Rostrovinsky went into hospitalized internment at Sasebo Naval Base in Japan, where he was treated with the utmost respect and where he was visited as an equal by Togo himself. Upon his return to Russia after the war, Rostrovinsky found, not unnaturally, that he was to be the scapegoat for yet another defeat for the Tsar's armed forces. Yet, as befitting his rank and past achievements, he was dealt with gently and was quietly retired on a generous pension. Nebogatov and Rostrovinsky's chief of staff were, together with certain other officers, were court-martialed and sentenced to be shot. Only the direct intervention of the Tsar prevented the executions. However, all served long terms of imprisonment. Russia did not regain a navy of consequence for over four decades. The navy of Imperial Japan rose in stature over the years to become ultimately an integral part of a system that required the combined efforts of several major nations to once again dim the flame of conquest. The Battle of Tsushima was fought at the only period in history when the steam-powered, ironclad line of battleship was supreme and before aircraft and submarine-launched torpedoes seriously threatened its existence. Togo and Rostrovinsky were, to quote Richard Howe, the only admirals ever to lead their fleets into a full-scale gunnery battle. Tsushima was the ironclad's finest hour, the one occasion in its brief history when it fulfilled its functions without interference. Next, please, Kev. And again. Now, this brings us to Sydney. There is the cruiser, the Japanese cruiser Asama, in 1925 in Circular Quay. After the First World War, she became a training ship and actually lasted quite some time. It's worth noting that the tug which is pulling her in there was a Brisbane tug called the Chelmsford. It's Chesterford, rather, if anyone knows of her. I don't know what a Brisbane tug was doing down here. You can see Fort Macquarie in the background. I'd like to see the contrast if she came out here now with the Opera House behind her. Next, please. And there is the Yakumo, who also came out with her in 1925, I think it was, being shunted into a position where the Maritime Services Board is now. I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, you're perfectly right. She became a training ship in 1925, she came out in the 30s, you're quite right.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, thank you very much indeed. Blimey, with the ready bridge up there. Yeah, certainly not a phantom coat hanger. But I think those are quite unique pictures, and I didn't even know of their existence until yesterday when I did the quickest copy job of all time on them. Next, please. Modern day. That's the New Jersey, letting fly. 16-inch, 2,400-pound shells, 26 miles absolute range, and equivalent of a bomber fleet. So, next please. Loading ammo, 14-inch in this case. There's enough of it there. That is actually on board the Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. The Second World War. I'm throwing these in just as a contrast. Next, please. Replenishment. Let's see. The contrast in size between what I've been talking about and what is in front of you shows the more or less the development of what was to come in only a passage of a bit of less than 30 odd years. Next. Well, it took more than one tug to put her in. I think you'll find there's about six there having a quick shifty. Once again, that was one of the Iowa class. I don't know which one. Next, please. There is almost a contemporary, well, that is actually the Texas. She's now moored near the San Jacinto Monument down there as the Texas State Memorial. A marvelous old dreadnought, and you can go over her quite a few times as well. I'm hoping that she'll be included in the tour. Next, please. And now the final act in the whole drama. The Mikasa still exists. She was dedicated as a national monument in Tokyo in 1961. She has become to the Japanese what the Victory has become to the British. Tsushima was to the Japanese what Trafalgar was to the British. and they equate the same men and Togo with the Japanese Nelson. That photograph I also got yesterday. Next, please. And that is the end, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ship's plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.